The PowerPoints aren't labeled by numbers, right?
Thank you all for standing by. At this time, the conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, good morning, everyone. Good afternoon. This is Amanda Hendricks. I'll be hosting the Charm Telecon today, and I'm pleased to introduce today's speaker, Dr. John Spencer of the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. John works on Cassini's composite infrared spectrometer, or the SIRS instrument, mapping temperatures of Saturn's moons, and he has also extensively studied the Galilean moons of Jupiter using data from the Galileo spacecraft as well as the Hubble Space Telescope. He's also on the New Horizons team, the spacecraft en route to Pluto, with a spectacular Jupiter flyby a few weeks ago. John is an expert on Jupiter's volcanic moon Io, and so it seems like a natural transition for him to now be studying Saturn's volcanic moon Enceladus. Today, John is going to tell us all about Enceladus, Cassini's discovery of volcanic activity, and the work that he and others have been doing to understand the sources and effects of that activity. So, John, please go ahead and start.
Okay, thank you, Amanda. I guess we'll move straight on to the first real slide, slide number two. And I'll just say a little bit about what we knew about Enceladus before Cassini got there, just to set the stage for all the amazing things that Cassini has found. So we first learned that Enceladus was weird a long time ago, back with the Voyager flybys in 1980 and 1981. I was lucky enough to be at the Voyager 2 flyby as a humble graduate student when we saw these pictures coming in, and they really blew everyone away as to what a strange world this was. As most of Saturn's small icy moons are pretty heavily cratered, maybe have a few plains regions, but Enceladus is intensely fractured, has these linear features all over it. What craters it does have are heavily modified. You can see craters here that look like they've almost just sort of melted back into the surface. And Voyager also showed that Enceladus has a very high albedo. Its surface is almost pure white. It's the brightest object in the solar system, and so that's telling you that there's something very unusual happening there. But we didn't really know what back then. The next slide, slide three, says something about what we thought was going on. Voyager, of course, had discovered the volcanoes on Io, and when we saw that Enceladus was so strange from Voyager, it suggested that something similar was happening on Enceladus, and that tidal heating was probably the source of the energy that was transforming the surface of Enceladus. And Enceladus is in a 2-to-1 resonance with Dione, a slightly larger moon further out. So every two orbits of Enceladus, Dione goes around once, and there are rhythmic perturbations on Enceladus from Dione that increase the eccentricity of the orbit, so it's not quite circular, and the eccentricity is about 0.5%. It's actually quite similar to Io's eccentricity, and that's enough to distort Io as it goes around its orbit, and its distance from Jupiter changes to produce the intense volcanic activity. So you can get a significant amount of heat into an object if it has this sort of eccentricity under the right circumstances. So there were a lot of papers published on the possibility of tidal heating in Enceladus, and but there was an enormous variation in how much power that people thought you could get out of this tidal heating, and anywhere from a few hundred megawatts, which actually isn't that much, it's similar to what you would get from radioactive decay inside Enceladus, to many gigawatts, which could probably be enough to explain why Enceladus was so peculiar. And there was some limit on this placed by the orbital evolution of Enceladus and how much energy Saturn could supply to the system to keep it warm, about 4 gigawatts, but pretty uncertain. There was also an idea proposed just before the Cassini data started coming in that rather than Enceladus being heated by its orbit being out of round, it would be heated by actually wobbling as it in its spin, that it would not be always keep exactly the same face to Saturn, as most moons do, but would actually wobble around that, and there are ways that might happen, and so that its shape would be distorted just by this spin wobble. So there were ideas kicking around back then that could produce a significant amount of heat. So moving on to slide four, there's always been a problem with these models in that if you look at Saturn, Enceladus' neighbor Mimas, and here are pictures of Mimas and Enceladus pretty much to scale, you can see Mimas is dead as a doornail. It's just covered in craters. Nothing very exciting has happened to it in its history other than impacts. But if you look at the numbers for what you would expect for tidal heating, Mimas is smaller than Enceladus, but it's much closer to Saturn, or significantly closer to Saturn, and its orbit is much more out of round. And so the tidal effects on it, Mimas should be a lot bigger than they are on Enceladus. And if you assume they're the same inside as each other, you'd have 10 times as much heat coming out of Mimas as you do out of Enceladus, and this is clearly not happening. And so the probable explanation for this is that Mimas has a very cold, rigid interior, so although there are quite strong tidal forces acting on Mimas, it doesn't really respond. It doesn't distort, or it distorts in a very elastic way that doesn't put any energy into it. And that would happen if it was cold. But Enceladus, because it's warm inside, it's squishy, it can distort in response to these tidal forces from Saturn, and that generates enough heat to keep it warm. So it's kind of a bistable situation that if you were to take Enceladus out of its orbit and just put it on one side, let it cool down until it was hard and rigid, and then put it back in its orbit, it would never warm up again, because it has to. It's a self-sustaining thing, that the heat you're putting into it is what allows the heat to continue to be put into it. So that means you need some way to get Enceladus started in the first place, and there's been a lot of speculation about how that might happen.
So are you suggesting that, say, if there were something to have gotten Mimas started way back when, then it could be in the same situation?
Probably, yes. Uh-huh. I mean, there are other factors that come into it, like Can you maintain that eccentricity once you've got dissipation inside a moon? That's going to make the orbit circular. And so you need some other force, like the influence of one of the other satellites, or combined with the influence of Saturn as well, to keep the orbit eccentric, so you can keep pulling energy out of the system without it just settling down into a circular orbit. So there is more going on than that. But what would probably happen is if you heated Mimas up, it would have tidal energy for a while, but then the orbit would just become circular because there aren't any forces maintaining its eccentricity.
Well, does it have as much water as Enceladus?
Yeah, well, it actually has more. You look on that little table, the density of Mimas is 1.2 grams per cubic centimeter. So, in fact, Mimas is mostly water, and Enceladus is significantly more rock, which may be part of the story as well. It may be that rock allowed it to heat up more than Mimas in the first place. Okay, let's go to slide 5. The other part of the puzzle that's had people's interest for several decades is the E-ring. This is a diffuse, faint, extremely faint outer ring of Saturn beyond the main rings. And it was first discovered in 1966. The image taken here, I think, was taken in 1981. And you see the ring as this little smudge poking out beyond the very exposed area of the main rings on the left side of Saturn. And the ring seems to be densest at the orbit of Enceladus. It's a blue color, which means it's made of very fine particles, and those fine particles should not last very long. There has to be something that's continually producing fine particles to make the E-ring and maintain it, and it seems to be concentrated at the orbit of Enceladus, so that immediately suggested that Enceladus was giving off particles in some mysterious way. And even back in the early 80s, there were suggestions that there might be geysers on Enceladus that could be spraying out these particles. So it's not a new idea. I thought it was crazy at the time, because there are craters on Enceladus, and parts of it are clearly very old in order to have those craters and to have some regions be active right this moment and other regions have been dead for millions or billions of years seemed peculiar to me. So I never believed this. I'll just go on record. But back in 1981, there was this illustration in National Geographic on slide 6 showing geysers on Enceladus, and you can see the E-ring in the background made up of particles from these. So National Geographic had it right substantially way back then. But it was all just speculation, of course, at the time. So moving on to slide 7, there's more interesting stuff that was discovered before Cassini got there. One is that there is a torus, a ring, not just of dust, but of OH gas around Saturn, concentrated near the orbit of Enceladus. And again, producing this much OH. OH is a byproduct of water. If you, you know, destroy water molecules, you produce OH. But there was just too much to be produced by normal processes of micrometeorites or sputtering, where charged particles are hitting the moons and knocking off OH molecules. And so this also suggested there was some source of gas in the system as well, beyond what you would expect. So moving to slide 8, getting into the Cassini observations. As Cassini was approaching Saturn, it was scanning the system. This is early, in early 2004 with the ultraviolet instrument, and found there was not just this OH in the system, but there was a lot of just oxygen atoms kicking around, neutral oxygen atoms, not ionized, forming a ring around Saturn, again sort of concentrated near the orbit of Enceladus. And so this was really strongly pointing to some source of water gas or something that could break down and produce oxygen and OH. And then, once Cassini got into orbit around Saturn, started taking pictures of the system, there were actually a series of images taken in January and early February 2005 to look for plume activity on Enceladus because of all this work that had been done before. And in fact, there was a plume seen, and this is an example of one of those pictures in the lower right, showing this sort of glow, this blob, this streak off the south side of Enceladus. But nobody really understood what was going on at the time, and there were questions about the could this be just some sort of lens flare from the camera, and so not too much was done with that at the time. But then we had our first close-up looks at Enceladus in February and March 2005, when we really got to see what it was like at much better resolution than Voyager. So moving on to slide 9 is one of my favorite pictures from those early flybys, just very gorgeous, spectacular pictures taken from those first close-up looks, showing the surface even more intensely deformed than than Voyager saw back in the 80s. This area here shows almost no impact craters. That means the surface is pretty young. Some processes have been destroying the craters that inevitably form on the surface. You look towards the horizon and you see very rugged cliffs and mountains. Clearly something very intense is happening on Enceladus here. Moving on to the next picture, this is looking at some of the older terrain, and again you're seeing these craters, these circular features that are clearly produced by impacts, but they look like they've melted down and are being absorbed back into the surface. The surface is clearly very weak, must be being heated from underneath, so the ice gets soft and flows like a glacier, and the craters just can't sustain their usual bowl-shaped shapes. And then in the lower right of this image, you again get a region where the craters have been completely destroyed by some very intense activity from the interior. So moving on to the next slide, which will be number 11, Cassini is wonderful in that it has so many different kinds of instruments that they can really attack a problem from many different directions. And one of the ways we were investigating Enceladus early on was with stellar occultations with the ultraviolet instrument, which Amanda, who introduced me, is involved in this instrument. And the idea here is you watch a star pass behind Enceladus, and you measure the brightness of the starlight as it winks out behind the moon and appears on the other side. And if there's no atmosphere, you expect a knife-edge, very sudden drop in the starlight as the star goes behind, and the same in reverse as the star comes out again. And in fact, that's exactly what we saw in the first occultation in February 2005. So here's a plot of the brightness of the star versus time, and full brightness, and then bang, the star disappears, and then bang, it reappears on the other side. And for a moon this size, no big surprise that you would get an effect like that. But we were still left with this mystery of what was going on there. But then there was an indication, not from the cameras, that something else was happening on Enceladus. And the other thing that Cassini carries is a magnetometer, just like you imagine flying past Enceladus with a compass and you watch the needle as you go past, and the compass needle basically goes crazy as you fly past Enceladus. And this plot shows on the first two flybys the direction that the compass needle would point during the flybys, and you see a very strong perturbation to the magnetic fields by Enceladus as the spacecraft flies past. And this requires something to be blocking Saturn's magnetic field or perturbing Saturn's magnetic field around Enceladus, and it requires that thing to be bigger than Enceladus itself, because the perturbation is spread over quite a large area. And this was extremely puzzling at the time. And in fact, going on to the next slide, in April 2005, we had a workshop at JPL to discuss what we'd learned about Enceladus and the other moons so far. And Michelle Doherty, who is on the magnetometer team, was presenting her results and saying, look, there's something very strange going on at Enceladus. We really need to look more closely. And the next flyby was scheduled for July 2005, just 3 months later. But Michelle argued successfully that instead of flying past at about 1,000 kilometers altitude, which was the original plan, that we should come in much closer. And she was able to negotiate a flyby at 175 kilometers. Some of us were a little nervous about this because we'd seen these images of the apparent plume at the South Pole, and this flyby was going to take us pretty close to the South Pole, and we would have hate to discover a plume by running the spacecraft into it. But we went ahead with this, and we were very glad that we did, as it turned out. So Michelle really deserves a lot of credit for making a lot of these discoveries happen by being very quick on the off the mark with interpreting the magnetometer data. So moving on to slide 14, these are now the views from the third flyby where we approached over the South Pole, and really this is the flyby that cracked the problem open and really told us what was going on. Earlier flybys earlier images had shown some peculiar stuff down by the South Pole, some dark streaks, and these are visible in this full disk image on slide 14. In the lower part of the image, they show up kind of bluish colored here. These were called tiger stripes early on, and the name seems to have stuck. If we go on to the next slide, slide 15, you can see a close-up of the South Polar region. And there is a series of four parallel bluish colored furrows on the surface, these tiger stripes. And then surrounding this, you can kind of see a boundary that's kind of scalloped going all the way around the South Polar region. The South Pole is maybe a third of the way up the picture from the bottom. And so something very different is happening at the South Pole than is happening elsewhere on Enceladus. Zooming in even further on the next slide is about the most detailed view we have so far of these four tiger stripe fractures. And the blue color means that we have large ice grains here. It's like looking at the blue color of ice in a glacier. If light passes through enough ice is pretty transparent, of course. But if light passes through a great thickness of ice, it will pick up a blue color. And so this means there's pretty coarse-grained ice here to pick up this color here. So something is unusual happening along these fractures, these tiger stripes. So going on to the next slide, slide 17 is a geological map of the South Polar region. And this shows how astonishingly symmetrical the geology is about the pole. The red line in this plot shows the boundary, that scalloped boundary of the South Polar terrain, and you see it's really perfectly centered on the South Pole, this very young region. And then the four tiger stripes in the middle, which are labeled C on the plot, are again perfectly centered right at the South Pole. And then the radiating northwards up towards the equator are what look like tension fractures. which again are pretty symmetrical. We don't really know what's happening in the upper left of the, oh, sorry, the upper right of this diagram, just because we don't have very good coverage there yet. Probably there are similar things happening there as well. And then this whole south polar region has little or no impact craters at all. As I said, some other areas have quite a lot of craters. And you can see an area on the right hand. I'm one of these people who can't tell left from right. You have to forgive me. But on the left hand side is an area with quite a lot of craters, but there are almost none, maybe none at all, in the South Pole. And that means it has to be really young if we have any understanding of the rate at which impact has hit Enceladus, probably less than 1 million years old. So moving on to the next slide, you can see a close-up now of the edge of this South Polar terrain. And what seems to be happening here is that the stuff from the lower right is pushing upwards, and it's driving up into these fractures, and it's splitting them open, and it's just like an axe splitting open wood. You can really see, just looking at the surface here, what some of these processes are going on. Ice is being forced up from the lower right into these wedges, where it just pries open the surface and causes these very fresh fractures that head northwards. So the images were pretty spectacular, but Cassini can do a lot more than take pictures. And the next slide shows the near-infrared spectrum of Enceladus seen by the VIMS instrument. This is the Visible and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, which measures the near-infrared spectrum where there's a lot of distinctive absorption bands that can tell you about the surface composition.
John?
Yes?
Can I interrupt you to go back to slide 18?
Mm-hmm.
What is the thinking on, you're saying that there's a lot of compression going on in material being forced up this crack, kind of from the lower right.
Right.
But then the crack is perpendicular to, the big crack is perpendicular to other what looks like cracks.
Yeah,
there's a
crack that, or a furrow, shall we say, that starting on the right-hand side of the image cuts across more or less to the middle and then turns down towards the lower left. And that's the edge, that's a furrow that marks the edge of the South Polar terrain all the way around the South Pole. And that doesn't seem to be a tension fracture, because it's, who knows what's going on there. But it looks very different from these fractures that are running up towards the upper left in the image. And so the tension fractures, we think, are the ones that go up towards the upper left and that originate in these Y-shaped or wedge-shaped regions. You can see almost two generations of them here.
So those are kind of old areas that are maybe not... Does that maybe signify that the activity used to go up that far or used to be over that far, but now it's...
I think it's all part of the same system. I mean, who knows, but... Paul Helfenstein has suggested, I'm not sure if he believes it, but as just to toss out the idea that there might actually be subduction going on here, and that you have the ice moving northwards away from the Tiger Stripe region, and it's reaching some barrier here, and it's being pushed down underneath the ice to the north, and so that trench that runs across from the right-hand side to the center and then down towards the lower left could be like a mid-ocean... Oh, so not a mid-ocean ridge, but an ocean trench on the Earth, where you actually have the ocean floor diving down underneath. And that's pretty speculative, and I'm not sure that the images really provide strong evidence for that. But the idea that stuff is pushing in that direction and splitting open the crust to the north, I think, comes across pretty clearly in these pictures.
Yeah.
Okay, so going back to the next slide, and the one that's labeled... titled Tiger Stripe Spectrum. You see, it's just so wonderful how Cassini can pick apart this problem and just look in so much detail. So we actually have maps of the spectrum across the surface, and in the upper right you can see a map of the infrared brightness of the surface and the dark color of the tiger stripes there. They're dark there because this wavelength is absorbed by water ice. So there's a lot of water ice there. It's coarse-grained, so the ice has a lot of chance to soak up the light. And the ice is coarse-grained. It's just what was seen by the blue color in the visible images. The ice is mostly crystalline. It's not glassy amorphous ice, which some people might have expected. You don't see any heat radiation coming out at these wavelengths, which you would if there were really high temperatures here. And then the next slide, slide 20, shows the spectrum in a bit more detail. And if you look at the end of the red arrow, there's a couple of little blips in the spectrum that are pointed out. These are due to organic materials, something that contains carbon and hydrogen. We don't know exactly what, but that is really concentrated along the Tiger Stripes. And the image at the bottom right shows a map of these stripes of bright material that are where those Tiger Stripes are. This is where those bands are strong. So there is organic material in here as well as a lot of coarse-grained ice. And there's a lot of carbon dioxide in that region. There isn't any ammonia frost, which some people might have expected. And you can also, there are some gases you could observe here as well as the surface, and in particular you should be able to see carbon monoxide coming off, and that's not seen. So moving on to slide 21, now this is the stuff that I have worked on with my colleague John Pearl at Goddard Space Flight Center. We have been looking at the heat radiation from all the moons, as Amanda said, but looking in particular at Enceladus. And the image in the upper right shows the temperature map of Enceladus that we obtained on approach during this July 2005 flyby. And you see, if you compare it to the view in the lower right, which is kind of what we expected, you see warm temperatures up near the equator, but we also see this much warmer region right down at the South Pole. And in the predicted model, there is nothing special that should be happening down there at all. So this is completely unexpected. There's just no way to heat the surface at the South Pole by sunlight enough to produce a signature like this. So moving on to slide 22, we can map out where the warm material is, and so this is like a weather map, I suppose, of the surface temperatures on Enceladus. And we see this warm material pretty much corresponds exactly to where the Tiger Stripes are. And going on to the next slide, slide 23. This is just showing, kind of getting some feel for how our data works. We have a field of view which we, or several fields of view which we scan across the surface. And here I'm just showing the fields of view where we pick up the highest temperatures. And you see there's a cluster of warm material in the upper part of this image near the ends of some of the Tiger Stripes, and a cooler region. And then the warmest regions of all are centered quite close to the South Pole or towards the bottom of this diagram. But there's quite a lot of variation across this area. So we really have quite a lot of information as to how the heat is distributed. So moving on to slide 24, you can actually, if you account for the resolution of the instrument, you can match this pretty well, the pattern that we see, if you assume that you have a region along the Tiger Stripes that's, say, at 135 Kelvin, which is pretty darn cold, but it's a lot warmer than the about 70 degree Kelvin temperature that you would expect the South Pole of Enceladus to be at. And if you, along each Tiger Stripe, you have a region that you can vary in width from, say, 120 to 600 meters, and using the, looking at the cartoon in the lower right, you can see how I've just adjusted that manually to produce some variation in brightness along the Tiger Stripes, you can match the pattern that we see really pretty well. So we're seeing similar kinds of temperatures on all the Tiger Stripes, and temperatures of at least 135 Kelvin, which is very peculiar. When you actually look at the spectrum, when you look not just at where the heat is coming from, but how the heat varies with wavelengths, or the heat radiation varies with wavelengths, you again find that you match this best if, instead of having the whole surface be at a warm average temperature like 81 Kelvin, that doesn't fit the spectrum. You need a small area of the surface to be much warmer than that. So about 1% of the surface at about 135 Kelvin will match the spectrum pretty nicely. So again, about 600 meters width of warm material running along all the Tiger Stripes will do this.
So you're seeing about a 60 degree Kelvin temperature difference then?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, the problem is in some of this material that's been released, it looks like there's only a 10-degree temperature
difference. Well, that's the thing. It's a little hard to present because what we see, if you just look at the average temperature in this region, you see from the earlier images our resolution is not so high. We're mixing together warm material and cold material in every spectrum we take. And so the average temperature is only a few, you know, maybe 85 Kelvin or something in our field of view. But when we look at the individual, when we look at the spectrum, we can actually see it's not just all the materials at that average temperature, it's a small fraction of the materials at a much higher temperature.
That makes a lot more sense. Thank you.
Yeah.
And is that small fraction indicated by the stars?
In the previous slide, slide 24.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I was still on 24. I didn't know that we
had. Yeah. Yeah. The stars are just showing where the warmest region on each Tiger stripe is.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. They're not actually showing very much. So probably would have been simpler to leave them out. But they're just highlighting that the temperature along each Tiger stripe or the amount of heat along each Tiger stripe lot, and that those are the warmest regions. Okay, so going up to slide 26, we can look at the total heat coming out and make some assumptions, and we get about 6 gigawatts of heat coming out. And there's quite a lot of uncertainty in this. It depends what you assume for the brightness of the warm material, for instance, which we don't know directly. But this is a lot of heat. Remembering the models that we had before Voyager had a hard time producing much more heat than this. A few gigawatts was about the most that you could get out of the system from tidal heating. So that's pretty interesting. Then slide 27 shows where we have a few observations at higher resolution, where we scanned the surface, not the whole surface, but we just got scattered looks across the South Polar region. And the warmest spectrum of any that we saw has temperatures of about 145 Kelvin, maybe 150. It's hard to say exactly what the highest temperature is, but something in that ballpark, and about 5% of that particular spectrum is at those temperatures. This is because we're zooming in closer and we're filling more of our field of view with warm material along the Tiger stripes. So moving to the next slide, we did a press release pretty soon after this discovery where we actually can locate the warm material along the Tiger stripes here, and we get the warmest material right over the stripes. So we don't have information over most of this image, but we do have information along this strip, and the warm stuff is right over the Tiger stripes. So heat's coming out of these things.
You see, this is exactly the slide that I found confusing.
Right, this is the average bench temperature, and even in that middle square, the one at 91 degrees, you've got a mixture of cold material and warm material, and the warm material is much warmer than 91 degrees. That's simply the average temperature.
Okay, so what you're saying, it's actually 130 to 140 Kelvin or something like
right.
that.
Right, okay. But trying to put all that on a nice press release graphic would have got way too complicated.
Yeah, but you know what? The way the press release came out, it looked like there was only a 10-degree difference, and scientifically that just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing is that I can't remember the exact timing, but we may not have figured out that we needed much higher temperatures when this came out. This was only about a week after we discovered this.
Right. Okay, thank you.
We do our best.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we also got a look at the North Pole because we flew... We approached Enceladus from the South Pole, but then right after we turned back and looked at the North Pole. And here we get a totally different story. In fact, the highest temperatures, or the temperatures we see at the South Pole, are around 33 degrees Kelvin. Incredibly cold, and that's because the South Pole has been in darkness for many years, since I think about 1997. There's been no sunlight forming on it, so it's had a long time to cool off. So you'd expect the temperatures to be this cold. But it means you don't have a lot of heat coming out from the interior in the North Pole keeping it warm. It's just was heated by the sun in the early 90s, and it's been cooling off ever since. And the Voyager images of the North Pole that I show here again show pretty heavily cratered region, and so you wouldn't expect necessarily to see a lot of heat coming out there. So that's pretty consistent. But the North and South Poles are very, very different. Moving on to slide 30, this is a graphic where I'm going to, through the talk, put together the evidence we have from the different instruments and see how it all hangs together. So here we have, this is like a slice through Enceladus. There's the disk of Enceladus centered on the South Pole, and it's just showing where the things are that we're seeing that are interesting. And so around the South Pole, we have this warm material that extends about 10 or 15 degrees away from the pole. And this will make more sense in a minute. Next, I'm going to go back to the ultraviolet instrument, which earlier had seen nothing with stellar occultations by Enceladus, but in this case, we were able to arrange for a star to pass behind Enceladus under the South Pole. And in this case, we got a very different story. The plot on the right shows that the brightness of the star decreases gradually before it hits the edge of Enceladus and then drops. But when it comes out again, it's in the knife edge again. So there is a... hang on a moment. I've got a... Just a moment.
Oh, that's John.
Levi, I'm calling.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry about that. And so we're seeing gas over the South Pole in the ultraviolet as well, confirming what the magnetometer saw. And not only do we see there's gas, we can tell what kind of gas it is from the spectrum. And it's in fact mostly water vapor. And we can measure the amount of water vapor from the rate at which it falls off with height. We can get some idea of the speed of the water vapor as it's escaping. It's pretty fast. It's about 400 meters per second. And the escape speed from Enceladus is only about 240 meters per second. So the gas that's coming out is just leaving Enceladus completely. And when you do the numbers, if this had been going on for the entire history of Enceladus, you'd have lost about 20% of Enceladus's mass in that period of time. So this is a pretty major phenomenon that's going on. It doesn't mean that Enceladus has lost 20% of its mass, because who knows how long this has been going on, but it could be that high, or it could even be higher. And this amount of water vapor coming out of the South Pole is just about the right amount to produce the OH and the H clouds that have been seen previously. So it's making a nice story here.
How long was that 20% loss, over what period of time?
That would be over 4 billion years.
4 billion?
Billion.
Billion.
Yes, so over the edge of the solar system, basically.
At some point,
if this had been happening continuously.
Because you just released a picture, I guess taken last August, that looks like a gigantic plume of material coming out.
Well, yes, there is a gigantic plume. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was wondering.
Yeah. And I'll show some of the images shortly. And I'm kind of showing in things in chronological order here, because as we were doing these discoveries in the summer of 2005, all we had were those early images, which didn't show the plume very clearly, and we weren't sure if it was real or not in the images. So we were inferring most of this from these other instruments. So the next slide, slide 33, now adds the next element to this picture of what's going on. We have a series of circles under the South Pole of Enceladus that track, the bigger the circle, the more water vapor was seen by Cassini at that point above the South Pole. And then the X's show where there was no water vapor seen at all on previous occultations. So again, we see this cloud of water vapor right over where the warm material is at the South Pole. So going on to slide 34, even better, we actually flew through the edge of this cloud of water vapor, and we have a mass spectrometer on board Cassini that can measure its composition directly. And so we actually were able to, this material that had been spewed out of the moon just minutes earlier, we could bring into our instrument and perform a chemical analysis on it. And consistent with what the ultraviolet instrument saw, it's mostly water vapor, but there's also carbon dioxide, nitrogen, methane, acetylene, what's the other one there?
Propane.
Sorry?
Propane.
Okay, I'm forgetting my organic chemistry. But yeah, there's just from what we could see on this one quick pass, there's quite a rich brew of materials here. So the pie chart kind of shows how it's mostly water vapor, but with a significant amount of this other stuff. This stuff will not pass water quality standards. It's very contaminated with a lot of other stuff.
So what would you estimate, if you can, the composition of the organics? Is this about 1%?
Yeah, I mean, these are the only molecules that have been identified with any certainty. It's very simple organics, methane, acetylene, and propane. But there's probably a lot more at the less than 1% level that the instrument just was not sensitive enough to see. This is all that we know directly so far.
Thank you.
Basic elements of life.
Well, yeah, right. It was pointed out pretty early on by Jeff Cargill that if you have water vapor, water ice, when it condenses, can incorporate a lot of other molecules into it. They get trapped in the molecular structure of the water ice. That's called a class rate. And you can get, about 10% of these other simple molecules trapped in water ice as a class rate. So that means this could have been the source of the material, that there was a class rate composition interior that inside that's decomposing to produce this. But it's pretty interesting there's no ammonia here. Ammonia has been a favorite antifreeze for the Saturn system and for other regions, other moons in the outer solar system for a long time. If you add ammonia to water ice, you lower the melting point by about 100 degrees, so you can produce volcanic activity. You can alter the surface at much lower temperatures, and so it's been a very popular concept that these objects have quite a lot of ammonia in them, and that makes it easier to have volcanic activity and explain some of the features we see. But there isn't any ammonia. That's the one thing we don't see.
Yeah,
okay,
I haven't seen that.
Slide 35. Now I've plotted on the same diagram the trajectory that the spacecraft took past Enceladus. And now the circles show the density of gas that was measured by the spacecraft in the region that it was flying through. So you see a gradual increase in density as we got closer to the south pole of Enceladus, and then a pretty rapid fall off as we went past up towards the north. So again, this hangs together. There's a big source of gas at the south pole. The slide 36 now shows dust observations. We can also measure the dust particles themselves as they hit the spacecraft. There's an instrument that will count those particles, estimate their sizes, and can actually estimate their compositions as well. And mostly saw particles bigger than a few microns in this observation. And again, you see the green circles represent how much dust there was, and you see there was a lot of dust on approach and very little dust on departure up towards the north. So again, we're seeing the source of dust over the South Pole. And you can make, it's a tricky calculation, but you can make some estimates as to how much dust has to be coming out of the South Pole, and it's at least a few hundred grams per second, and that is getting up to be enough to produce the E-ring. So we really think we found the source of the E-ring here. And then the magnetometer, of course, was taking data as well. And if you're looking at the PDF, you won't probably see the nice transition here. But on the PowerPoint, I first show the data from the first two flybys, and then the data from the third flyby, which shows, again, a big perturbation. This is a day of year 195. A big perturbation just to the south of Enceladus. And so again, consistent with everything else we've seen. And then the next slide shows the famous image of the plume that we've taken quite a few months later. This was in November 2005. Cassini got a chance to look back at the night side of Enceladus and sees the surface backlit by the sun, which is a good way of seeing fine particles. Like, if you want to look at smoke, it's a lot easier to see smoke looking towards the sun than it is away from the sun. And these very fine particles show up best that way. So here's a view now that clinches the reality of the plume that was seen earlier by Cassini earlier in the year, and sees all these very fine jets coming out of the south polar region, which in this image is to the lower left. So fine jets visible on the left-hand image, and then on the right-hand image is an enhanced version of that shows that the fine jets are just part of an enormous, broader plume of material coming out here. And the next slide, 39, just says there's some peculiar things about this. The particles fall off very rapidly, the brightness falls off very rapidly within tens of kilometers of the surface. And that means that most of the particles are not actually escaping, even though most of the gas is escaping. The particles are mostly not going that fast, and they're falling back to the surface. But then, above 50 kilometers or so, then there's a much more gradual fall-off, and that means that a significant fraction of the particles, but mainly only about 1% of them, are actually escaping. So from the image, we can tell a great deal about what's really happening close to the surface that we can't probe with the other instruments. And slide 40 then puts the plume image in the context of all these other observations. And so now we can see the plume again exactly corresponding to where the warm material is on the surface. And the dotted line kind of extrapolates out where the edge of the plume is from that one image, which doesn't cover a very large area. And you see that the spacecraft just kind of skirted the edge of this plume as it came past. So the densities of gas and dust that we measured are much smaller than we'll potentially be able to measure if we get closer to Enceladus. So slide 41 now shows yet more wonderful data from that same observation by the VIMS instrument, which can measure the infrared spectrum of the plume material itself. We can actually measure the spectrum of those particles as they're being ejected. And I won't go into too much detail here, except that the green spectrum in this plot in the lower right shows a strong signature of water ice. So again, we're confirming that the particles coming out are mostly made of water ice, but it's very fine-grained water ice. That's the only way to match the spectrum. So slide 42 just talks a little bit about the heat, the power that we're seeing coming out. We see about 6 gigawatts of heat being radiated. But if you actually look at just the energy required to convert all the ice in the interior to water vapor, that's another gigawatt right there just to supply that rate of water vapor. And so 7 gigawatts at least coming out of Enceladus, and this amount of power is kind of hard to do by tidal heating if we want to maintain this long term. And in fact, there's a paper just coming out now that says it's completely impossible to maintain it long term by Mayer and Wisdom. And that's kind of awkward, because if it's not maintained long term and it's only happening occasionally, it's a little interesting that we showed up at just the right moment when it happened, this very rare phenomenon happened to be occurring. So maybe that's really what's happening, but it makes it a little unlikely. So we're not really sure what to make of that yet. And then, as we said earlier, clearly we have tidal heating going on. We certainly can't think of any other way than tidal heating to produce these many gigawatts of power. And so we still need a way to get Enceladus started, but not Mimas. And it's been suggested that maybe when Enceladus formed, it formed very, very early, shortly after the solar system condensed out of material from a supernova. And that supernova 4.5 billion years ago would have had produced a lot of very intensely radioactive elements that would have produced an enormous amount of heat, and aluminum 26 is the most popular of these. So if you'd had that much heat around early on, you could certainly have warmed up Enceladus and kick-started the process and allowed the tidal heating to continue since then. But there are other problems like that. If there was that much aluminum 26 around when Saturn formed, you would have melted all the moons, and that's not necessarily what we see. So it's possible, but we hope there's some other explanation, I guess. It's possible that just regular radioactive heat, the kind that's keeping the Earth warm right now, would be enough to kickstart the tidal heating, but you kind of have to push the models to make that work. Or maybe there's been an impact on Enceladus that knocked it out of its circular orbit and produced a temporary pulse of heat that then allowed the tidal heating to get going. We really don't know what's going on there. And if you look at the total heat just coming out of the South Polar region where it's concentrated, the amount of heat flow, if you just have ice that is, the heat is being conducted through that ice has to get pretty warm, pretty near the surface, and it would be molten at a depth of only 20 meters, 60 feet below the surface, if that heat was just coming out by conduction through the ice. So we've got liquid water very close to the surface, if that's really what's going on. And going on to slide 43, this is an idea that has caused a lot of discussion. The paper on the imaging results pointed out that the amount of gas coming out of the surface seems to be quite similar to the amount of ice coming out of the surface if you make a lot of assumptions about what the processes are. And it's kind of hard to produce that much ice from condensation of gas. And so there, the argument made in that paper is that the best way to produce that many ice particles with that amount of gas would be to have boiling water near the surface. So they're suggesting the water really is, liquid water is really occurring very close to the surface. It's boiling off into a vacuum, and that produces all the ice particles we see. And this is, it's a plausible argument. Complicating factor is if you actually look at the relative speeds of the ice, of the dust and the gas, that the amount of, the rate at which you have to produce ice particles is a lot lower than the rate at which you have to produce gas particles, and maybe you could do that by condensing vapor. If you just look at this straight, then, yeah, you know, there's an argument for maybe liquid water close to the surface there. And slide 44 talks about a recent paper by Sue Kiefer and others that I was involved in. Again, looking at the abundance of these non-water constituents, the carbon dioxide and the nitrogen and the organics, that are similar to what you get from class rates. And if you expose class rates to a vacuum, you might be able to get an explosive reaction where they decompose rapidly and produce these jets of vapor, which could explain what you see. Might be an explanation for the plumes. But you need pretty high temperatures even there, probably over 190 Kelvin, in order to get the water to vaporize that we see in the plume. Another puzzle that's addressed on slide 45 is why would this be happening at the South Pole? Remember, we have this amazing symmetry of the geology around the South Pole. And so an idea that Francis Nimmo and Bob Pappalardo published last year is that suppose you just have, in some random place on Enceladus, you have heat concentrated by tidal heating processes, well, however you want to do that, near the surface or even deeper in the interior. You could heat up the surface there and you produce low-density material there. And so you'd have a ball of ice that's mostly symmetrical, mostly the same everywhere, but there's one region that's lower density, doesn't weigh as much. And that produces, if it's spinning, that produces an unstable situation. And in fact, the way to make it stable again is for the body to rotate so that the low-density material is concentrated at the pole. That then becomes stable, and it will spin stably after that. And so it's possible that the activity did not start at the South Pole. It started in some random place, and that caused the moon to flip so that the activity was then centered at the South Pole.
But then you have to have a mechanism for starting the activity in some random place.
Yeah. I mean, that's where the arm waving comes in.
Right.
And this model doesn't address that in any detail. It simply explains why you would have this coincidence of the activity with the pole.
Do they suggest particular ways that you might get that, though? I mean, would that be like an impact or something?
No, they're thinking of internal processes, I think, some kind of diapir. There are processes. Once you get a zone of weakness, you'll get more deformation there, and that produces more heat there, which could make it weaker, and so you could get a runaway effect where a small area of weakness, because of the tidal heating, becomes a much larger area of weakness. And so it's plausible that this would actually work this way. But if this is really true and we have a low-density region below the South Pole, you might be able to detect the gravity anomaly from that, and so that might be something that we could see in future flybys. Moving on to slide 46, there's been other work recently on the heat production mechanism. And one way to produce this amount of heat is just simply you have a fracture and the tides are pulling on Enceladus, and they're causing motion along this fracture every day as Enceladus orbits Saturn and its distance from Saturn varies. And you can calculate those stresses should be and how much heat should be produced. And you can produce models like this diagram here that shows how the temperatures are warmer along a fracture below the surface. And you can produce quite a lot of water vapor this way. Some of and if you assume that most of that recondenses near the surface, it freezes out as it gets to the very cold near surface regions, but then warms those regions up in the process. But that some of it escapes to produce the plumes, you can actually make the numbers work out pretty well for the amount of heat we see coming out and the amount of vapor we see coming out. But to get the amount of stress required to make the numbers work, you actually need to have an ocean inside Enceladus so that the ice layer on top is free to distort it to the full extent as Enceladus orbits Saturn. So I wouldn't call this proof of an ocean, but it's kind of pointing in the direction that, like Europa around Jupiter, there may be an ocean beneath the surface. Even if there isn't liquid water right at the surface, as the imaging team suggested, that there might be an ocean lower down. Because this model doesn't require liquid water very close to the surface.
John, how is an ocean consistent or not with magnetometer measurements compared with, say, Callisto?
Yeah, I think the magnetometer data just aren't good enough yet.
Okay.
And they may not get good enough on the in the Cassini mission because the there's this enormous signature from the water vapor cloud, which you don't have to deal with at Callisto or...
Right.
And that confuses the issue quite a lot, as I understand it. Okay, so slide 47 now shows... In this model, you can actually predict how the heat should vary along the tiger stripes, and this is one of those predictions from this paper. And you can actually compare this to models. You can look at what the signature should be, the heat signature should be at the resolution of the Cassini data that we have so far. And, you know, it kind of matches in some ways. We have a warm area in the upper left and a warm area in the lower right, but then we have kind of a cool region over the pole in this model, which doesn't match the data. The data are on the left and the model predictions are on the right. And but so it's, you know, it's promising, but it's clearly not the whole story, or it's not quite that simple. Okay, moving on to slide 49. We've had another look at the South Pole since then with the SEERS instrument to look at the temperatures again. And the lower right image shows the... It's actually a more direct view of the South Pole than we got in July 2005. And we see the hot spot still there, still looking pretty much the same, still about the same brightness. But an interesting thing is you can see from this diagram on page 49, this image, that... we were looking pretty obliquely in 2005, but in 2006 we were looking almost straight down on the South Pole. And so we thought we might see a lot higher temperatures there. If we're really seeing narrow cracks with hot material in them, as we're looking straight down, we'll see deeper into the cracks and we should see more heat. But we actually see pretty much exactly the same amount of heat. This is a spectrum from late 2006, and the temperature we're getting of 127 Kelvin there is about the same as what we'd get on the... in the earlier data. So we're not seeing a lot of hot material in cracks. We're seeing, we think most of the heat we're seeing is from a warm surface away from the cracks, not from the cracks themselves. Power is about the same, though it is somewhat uncertain on slide 51. Then slide 52 shows the map again of the temperature distribution across the surface. And given the uncertainties, it's pretty much the same. We see again the warm region in the upper right and the but the main warm region is in the lower left of this diagram. So things haven't changed too much in the course of a year and a half. Now, slide 53 shows another example of the amazing data that Cassini is getting. This is an image taken looking back towards the sun during a solar eclipse last September. And here's Enceladus now in the heart of the E-ring. And if you ever had any doubts about whether Enceladus was creating the E-ring, this should dispel them. You see that it's right in the center of the ring. It's really messing up the ring as it plows through it. And you see jets and streamers coming off. Enceladus itself is just a little black dot in the middle of this picture. And because we're looking at the night side, we don't see much light from Enceladus itself. And then the very bright dot beneath the black dot is the plume, very brightly lit up by the back illumination of the sun. So there's a lot of incredible stuff going on here. The slide 54, I'm going to start talking a little bit about future observations. We have the nominal mission of Cassini extends through the middle of 2008, so we have about 15 months to go. And there are plans for an extended mission after that, and these are not official yet. We don't have official approval of those, but we have been making plans because we need to get started on the planning. And we're certainly hoping for a long and productive extended mission, but it's still tentative at this stage. But one thing we do know we're going to do is next March. Today is actually a big day for Enceladus because we're getting another look at the plumes at high phase angle today. If you check the Raw Images website on the Cassini website, in maybe by tomorrow, I'm not sure, there may be some new detailed pictures of the plumes, better than we've seen since that first view from November 2005. So we're looking forward to that view. But then the next time we get really close to Enceladus will be in March next year. And the current plan is to fly by at an altitude of 25 kilometers. But that's currently what we're planning to do. The navigation people think that's a safe altitude to fly. And then just less than a minute later, we fly over the South Pole at much higher altitude. And we will then be able to turn back and look at the South Pole, maybe from 10,000 kilometers range a few minutes later. And the only problem with looking back at the South Pole at this time is that Enceladus goes into Saturn eclipse. The lights go out right as we go past, and so we won't be able to get any more detailed pictures of the South Pole, which is a region, which is a shame. But we will be able to look at the temperature distribution. We'll be able to map the temperatures there, and we're certainly looking forward to that opportunity. Slide 55 shows the trajectory. The diagonal white line shows the planned flyby in March 2008. And you can see how incredibly close to the surface you get near the equator. And then we go right through the plume, much closer in than we did on the last flyby. But those time ticks are every 10 seconds, and that's how quickly this happens. There's very little time to gather this really high-priority science in this period. Slide 56 then talks about the extended mission, where we have now decided what trajectory we're going to fly if this is approved. And not surprisingly, considering all we've discovered so far, Enceladus is a major priority for the extended mission. In fact, there are 7 additional close Enceladus flybys planned, and we're hoping to take pictures of the Tiger Stripes, showing details as small as tens of meters or even a few meters. It should be really spectacular. We'll be looking at the plumes themselves under favorable illumination conditions at tens of meters per pixel. That's, I'm sure, will be really spectacular too. We'll be measuring the heat radiation and the composition, seeing details as small as about a kilometer. The best data now is about 6 kilometers. We'll be doing more searches for the atmosphere using stellar occultations. Be looking at other places, not just at the South Pole. And then with the in-situ instruments that are measuring the plume as we fly past it, we can measure the composition of individual dust grains. We can measure the gas composition much more sensitively than has been done before, and we may find some more exotic and interesting molecules.
What's the density of the surface of the moon?
I'm sorry?
Density of the surface in general, I mean, of the surface. Would you walk down it? Would you cave in? Or?
Oh, we don't really know. There's some evidence that the surface is very fluffy, but that's only telling you about the top few millimeters.
Right.
And
could you land something on it, you think?
We're looking into that. I think you probably could. But it would be very hard to be certain in advance that it would be successful. I think it's probably the surface is like freshly fallen snow, because that's kind of what it is. The reason it's so bright is that there is dust falling out onto the surface from the plume and from the E-ring all the time. And so, yeah, I suspect it's kind of a soft surface, but that you could land something on it.
Thank you.
And then we'll look at the plasma and the gravity field as well. Slide 57 gives a table of the planned encounters. The top one is the one that is in the main mission, and we know it's going to happen on 12th of March 2008. But then we have these other 7 with different geometries and different distances and different speeds as we go by. And so we're now in the process of deciding what we do on all these encounters.
Absolutely fascinating.
So this is slide 57, going to, on to slide 58. This now shows on the right-hand side how all these additional trajectories fly through the plume, or not. So the bright green line is our flyby in, on orbit 11, and the sort of olive drab, I suppose, diagonal line now is the flyby that we're planning next March. But you see the red line shows two of the flybys that we're planning in the extended mission, which go even deeper into the plume and will show, allow us to sample the plume with even more, you know, look at even denser regions and get a more accurate measurement of the composition. And then the orange line coming across from east to west are the closest flybys that we're currently planning on orbits 120 and 130, which are just 100 kilometers over the plume source. And we have a working group that Amanda is actually leading to try and figure out if this is crazy or not, and whether it's really safe to fly that close over the plume. If we run into a particle that's bigger than a millimeter or two, it could destroy the spacecraft. And so we're trying to convince ourselves that there are no particles that big that could get that high. But it's not an easy calculation to make, and we're being very cautious about that, understandably. And the image in the lower left shows the kind of pictures we could take. Here again is a crescent image where we're hoping we could zoom in on the South Pole. This white square is the field of view of our narrow angle camera on the spacecraft. We can fill an image, fill that square with a high resolution image and get incredible detail on these jets of dust as they come out of the Tiger Stripes. So that's going to be something to look forward to. The next slide shows the kind of imaging of the surface we hope to be able to get. This is a view of the surface during the first, or one of the first flybys where we'll be able to look at the surface. Showing an image, this, again, the white square shows the size, the field of view of our camera. As we pull away, the field of view gets bigger. But we'll get some images zooming in on these very small areas you see on the left-hand side, and then progressively larger areas. The red vertical rectangle shows the field of view of the SEERS instrument, the temperature mapping instrument. So we can measure temperatures along stripes like that at each of these positions, or wherever we want to put these views on the surface as we fly past. And the little inset in the lower right shows what the surface of Enceladus looks like at this very high resolution. This is an image that was taken, our only very high resolution view we have, and you see a very rough surface apparently covered in boulders, which is not at all what we expected. That is the kind of information we can get over much larger areas during these close flybys. So the last slide, number 60, summarizes all this, that we found kind of a holy grail of planetary science, really, which is a living ice world. Most of the bodies in the solar system, most of the solid bodies, we see traces of geological activity from the past, but we don't see much going on now. The Earth, of course, is very geologically active, and Jupiter's moon Io has its amazing volcanoes. But this is the first ice world we have seen where geology is happening right under our noses. And it allows us to study processes that we think have happened in other places in the outer solar system, on other ice worlds, but there we can only pick over the remains of what happened and try and reconstruct it. Here we can see it happening in front of our eyes. And we're pretty sure that the heat source is tidal. We can't think of anything else that would produce this amount of heat, but we sure don't understand how this much heat is coming out. And there are good arguments that can be made that there's liquid water close to the surface, but then there are, you can think of ways of explaining the what we see without liquid water near the surface. So we don't know if there is liquid water near the surface, but it's certainly plausible, and there are stronger arguments that there is heat deeper in the interior, or that there's liquid water deeper in the interior. So we have probable liquid water somewhere inside there. We have organic molecules. It really is an area where a region where we can imagine that life might gain a foothold, and it may arguably the most promising place in the solar system that we currently know of where life could exist right now. There's a big ocean, we're pretty sure, under the surface of Europa, the big moon of Jupiter, a much bigger ocean than it could possibly inside in tiny Enceladus. That ocean is locked under kilometers of ice. We have no way of directly sampling it that we can conceive of technologically right now. Whereas to sample the interior of Enceladus, all you need to do is fly through the plume, and we're already doing that with Cassini. So we have an opportunity for really understanding what's happening here, maybe clinching whether or not there is liquid water here. And with all these extended mission flybys that we're planning on Cassini, there's a chance of very dramatic discoveries still to come, and we ain't seen nothing yet. And that's basically my talk, and I'm happy to entertain more questions.
Great, thanks, John. Does anybody have more questions?
Yes, I do. This is Ken in North Carolina. Two questions. First off, my nuclear science is a bit rusty. What are the decay products of aluminum-26, and is there a way to sample for those as you're flying through the plume?
Aluminum-26 decays into helium-26, and we know aluminum-26 was present in the Earth system because we see excesses of magnesium-26 in meteorites. And so we know it was present when meteorites formed. I think it's a small fraction of the interior. I don't think it's anything we could detect, or we could detect magnesium-26, but we wouldn't know where it came from. And it's all in the details of not just other magnesium-26 atoms, but when were they incorporated into the object? Were they incorporated as aluminum or as magnesium? And to do that, you need to do a detailed chemical analysis that we couldn't possibly do with Cassini. Maybe on some future mission.
John, I have a question. David, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay, thanks. It would be fascinating to hear a comparison of this world versus Callisto and Europa.
Yeah, I mentioned a little bit about that. Enceladus has a lot in common with Europa, not so much with Callisto. Callisto appears to be geologically dead. There's evidence for liquid water in the interior, but very little happening on the surface. But Europa and Enceladus have a lot in common. Europa is much, much bigger. It's about 10 times the diameter of Enceladus. And we have a lot more information about the surface geology of Europa, and that's pretty much convinced most people that there is a layer of